everyone. Welcome to episode number 40, big 4-0 of Thomas and the Bible. And good news and bad news today. The bad news is this reading is pretty bad. It's got a little going on toward the end, but it starts really poorly and boringly. Good news is we are just cleaning up Numbers, and we're going to be done with the book of Numbers and going on to Deuteronomy, which is exciting. And I think that'll be one more book, and then we will be done with Moses, because I am, let me tell you, a little sick of Moses. A little bit. So let's get started with this boring first chapter here. These are the journeys of the children of Israel, which went forth out of the land of Egypt with their armies under the hand of Moses and Aaron. And Moses wrote their goings out according to their journeys by the commandment of the Lord, and these are their journeys according to their goings out. It was sort of like a palindrome there, that verse. And they actually, a lot of the Bible's like that. It's like this. And that was this. And it sort of like reverses the order of it sometimes. That's funny. And they departed from Ramses in the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the morrow after the Passover of the children of Israel, went out with an high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians. For the Egyptians buried all their firstborn, which the Lord had smitten among them. Upon their gods also the Lord executed judgments. And the children of Israel were removed from Ramses and pitched in Succoth, and they departed from Succoth and pitched in Etham, which is in the edge of the wilderness. And they removed from Etham and turned again unto Pihahiroth, which is before Baal Zephon, and they pitched before Migdol. And so if you don't get it yet, this is, for some reason, Moses has decided to just sum up everything that's happened, you know, just in case, you know, we didn't read the first part of the entire Bible. Well, not the entire Bible, but of the entire Moses part. You know, he's putting it in there again. Just, you never know. So, and they departed from before Pihahiroth and passed through the midst of the sea into the wilderness and went 3 days' journey in the wilderness of Etham and pitched in Marah. Oh, remember that? Yeah. And they removed from Marah and came unto Ilim, and Ilim were 12 fountains of water and 70 palm trees. That's important. Do you remember it? Now I need to remind everyone just how many palm trees there were. And they pitched there. And they removed from Elim and encamped by the Red Sea. And they removed from the Red Sea and encamped in the wilderness of Sin. And they took their journey out of the wilderness of Sin and encamped in Daphka. And they departed from Daphka and camped in Alesh. And they removed from Alesh and encamped in Rephidim. And there was no water for the people to drink. And they departed from Rephidim and pitched in the wilderness of Sinai. And they removed from the desert of Sinai and pitched at Kibrothava. And they departed from Kibrothava and encamped at Hazeroth. And they departed from Hazeroth and pitched... I take it back. This reading is awesome. I don't know why I started off by saying it was a poor reading for selection for today, but because it's really just great. It's me. I'm in a bad mood. I just, you know... And they departed from Rithmah and pitched in Rimapres. And they departed from Rimapres and pitched in Libna. And they removed from Libna and pitched in Rissa. And they journeyed from Rissa and pitched in Kehathotha. And they went from Kehathotha and pitched from Mount Shafer. And they removed from Mount Shafer and encamped in Haradah. And they removed from Haradah and pitched in Machaloth. And guess what they did then? They removed from Machaloth and encamped at Tahath. But that was short-lived, as they departed from Tahath and pitched at Terah. And they removed from Terah and pitched in Mithkah. And they went from Mithkah and pitched in Hashmanah. And they departed from Hashmanah and camped at Mezaroth. And they departed from Mezaroth and pitched in Benajikan. And they removed from Benajikan and encamped at Horhadigdad. And, oh my gosh, this is so stupid. Okay, skip, skip, skip. And they remove from Kadesh and Mount Hor and the edge of the land. And Aaron the priest went up into Mount Hor at the commandment of the Lord and died there at his command. In the 40th year after the children of Israel were come out of the land of Egypt, in the first day of the fifth month. Ah, yes. I remember that. Now, I wonder if this was yet another attempt for Moses to buy some time, since the Lord has told him he's going the way of Aaron. You know, he's gonna be killed soon. All right, Moses, you've fulfilled your purpose here, and it's time to be taken up unto your people. Well, you know, God, I was thinking, oh, yeah, I'm so ready to be killed, but just one thing is just nagging me. I'm thinking maybe it wouldn't hurt if we just, you know, put in like a summary of everything that's happened. So I could spend some time on it, take a few years, write, like rewrite, sort of just an, you know, summary of everything we've done. Well, that's ridiculous. We already just wrote it down in the book. Why, you've been writing all this the whole time, right? I mean, why couldn't they just refer back to that? Well, true. That's a good point. But I mean, would it really hurt to just make sure that they understand every single campsite we stopped at, however insignificant it was? Because there are totally some campsites that we just stopped and, you know, like went to the bathroom. But I didn't mention them the first time. And you never know, you know? All right, fine, Moses, have it your way. So that's how that happened. And Aaron was 123 years old when he died in Mount Hor. And King Arad the Canaanite, which dwelt in the south of the land of Canaan, heard of the coming of the children of Israel. And they departed from Mount Hor and pitched in Zalmanah, and they departed from Zalmanah and pitched in Punon, and they departed more of this. And I'm going to skip Alberth, Ejibjim, Imdijibit. He should just list the places, because we get, you know, the formula for these verses now. I think I'm picking up on it. Something like wherever they were, they left it and went to another place. Something like that. Something like that. Almond Diblatham. All right, never mind. That just made it worth it. They removed from Dibungad and encamped in Almond Diblatham. Almond Diblatham. Sounds delicious. And they removed from Almond Diblatham and pitched in the mountains of Abram before Nebo. Well, that's that. And they departed from the mountains of Abram and pitched in the plains of Moab. Now I'm not excited anymore. And the Lord spake unto Moses in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho, saying, speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, when ye are passed over Jordan in the land of Canaan, then ye shall drive out all the inhabitants of the land from before you, and destroy all their pictures, and destroy all their molten images, and quite pluck down all their high places. And ye shall dispossess the inhabitants of the land, and dwell therein, for I have given you the land to possess it. And ye shall divide the land by lot for an inheritance among your families, and to the more ye shall give the more inheritance, and to the fewer ye shall give the less inheritance. Every man's inheritance shall be in the place where his lot falleth. But if ye will not drive out the inhabitants of the land before you, then it shall come to pass that those which ye let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein ye draw. Yeah, I'd say that's pretty accurate advice. There isn't really anything too, you know, spooky or prophetic about, you know, God telling him, look, Moses, if you steal all this land over here, like I'm telling you, and you don't kill everyone in it, oh, anyone left over is going to be a pain in your ass, let me tell you. Trust me on this one. I think that's, you could probably figure that out for yourself. I don't think God really needed to tell us that. Moreover, it shall come to pass that I shall do unto you as I thought to do unto them. Wow. I know I say this every time. Every time. But now God is not even hiding the fact that his chosen people are just completely arbitrary. He actually said this. If you don't kill all these people and take their land, I'll have them kill all you and take your land. Like, so why is he picking one or the other? He's just completely admitting that he just wants war or something. He just, like, how arbitrary is that? He doesn't care. If they don't do what he says, then he'll have the other ones kill him. And it's like, come on. Wow. All right. Well, that was a really long summary chapter, and we're done with it. So let's move on to a real chapter. All right. So if you thought the last chapter was unexciting, just wait till you hear this one. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, command the children of Israel, and say unto them, when ye come into the land of Canaan, this is the land, this is the land that shall fall unto you for an inheritance, even the land of Canaan with the coasts thereof, in parentheses. Then your south quarter shall be from the wilderness of Zin, along by the coast of Edom, and your south border shall be the outmost coast of the salt sea eastward. And your border shall turn from the south to the ascent of Akrabim, and pass on to Zin, and the going forth thereof shall be from south of Kadesh Barnea, and shall go on to Hazradeth here, and pass on to Asmon. And the border shall fetch a compass from Asmon unto the river of Egypt, and the goings out of it shall be at the sea. And as for the western border, ye shall have even have the great sea for a border. This shall be your west border. And this shall be your north border. From the great sea ye shall point out for your Mount Hor. And from Mount Hor ye shall point out your border unto the entrance of Hamath. And the goings forth of the border shall be to Zedad. And the border shall go unto Ziphron. And the goings out of it shall be at Hazaranan. This shall be your north border. And ye shall point out your east border from Hazaranan to Shepham. And the coast shall go down from Shepham to Riblah on the east side of Ain, and the border shall descend and shall reach unto the side of the sea Chinnereth eastward. And the border shall go down to Jordan, and the goings out of it shall be at the salt sea. This shall be your land with the coast thereof round about. So I love how really what must have happened here is Moses and his friends just decided, like, hey, guys, if we could have any land and just pick whatever it is, where would you draw your borders? And everyone's like, oh, I would take it all the way to the ocean, the Jordan River, like all that crap. And then they're just like, okay, let's just say that some all-powerful being gave us that land, and then we'll just kill everybody and take it. Yeah, that's about what happened. And Moses commanded the children of Israel, saying, this is the land which ye shall inherit by lot, which the Lord commanded to give unto the nine tribes, and to the half tribe, for the tribe of the children of Reuben according to the house of their fathers, and the tribe of the children of Gad according to the house of their fathers, have received their inheritance, and half of the tribe of Manasseh have received their inheritance. So I guess there were 12, but half of them. Two tribes have already received their inheritance, and half of another. Oh, I think that was in the last chapter when some of the people were going off to war and they left some of the people behind, I guess. I think. Who cares? The two tribes and the half tribe have received their inheritance on this side Jordan near Jericho eastward toward the sun rising. Yeah, I think that's what that was. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, these are the names of the men which shall divide the land unto you. Eleazar, the priest, and Joshua, the son of Nun. And ye shall take one prince of every tribe to divide the land by inheritance. And the names of the men are these. Of the tribe of Judah, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh. Of the tribe of the children of Simeon, Shemuel, the son of Amihud. Of the tribe of Benjamin, Eldad, the son of Chislon. And the prince of the tribe of children of Dan, Buki, the son of Jogli. That one, he has to be made up. There's no way that wasn't there before. I've never said that. I wonder if someone just like entered in a fake name just to get like another share of the inheritance. Yes, Buki, the son of, Jogli. Yeah, that sounds about right. The prince of the children of Joseph for the tribe of the children of Manasseh, Haniel, the son of Ephod. And the prince of the tribe of the children of Ephraim, Kemuel, the son of Shiftan. And the prince, almost done with this one, and the prince of the tribe of the children of Zebulun, Elzaphan, the son of Parnach. And the prince of the tribe of the children of Issachar, Paltiel, the son of Azan. and the prince of the tribe of the children of Asher, Ahud, the son of Shilomi, and the prince of the tribe of the children of Naphtali, Pedahel, the son of Amihud. These are they whom the Lord commanded to divide the inheritance unto the children of Israel in the land of Canaan. All right. So now we're going on to a chapter that's not exciting, but has things in it. It sort of has things that happen a little bit. And the Lord spake unto Moses in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho, saying, Command the children of Israel that they give unto the Levites of the inheritance of their possessions cities to dwell in, and ye shall give also unto the Levites suburbs for the cities round about them. And the cities shall they have to dwell in, and the suburbs of them shall be for their cattle, and for their goods, and for all their beasts. And the suburbs of the cities which ye shall give unto the Levites shall reach from the wall of the city outward 1,000 cubits round about. I think this is the textbook definition of counting your eggs before they hatch. I know he's God and all, but I love how they're making all these plans, like, for the exactly how they're going to lay out these cities in a land that they haven't really gotten around to stealing yet. They're still... Reminds me of how, like, in World War II, Hitler had complete plans for how he was going to use the U.S., you know? Like, well, probably almost the whole world, but I saw in a documentary he had all these people, like, tasked to which areas of the U.S. they were going to control and all this stuff. And I really don't see how this is any less evil. I mean, it's somebody just taking over land that's not theirs and planning it. You know, it's pretty funny. And it's not funny. And it's funny. And you shall measure from without the city on the east side 2,000 cubits, and on the south side 2,000 cubits. On the west side, guess how many cubits? 2,000, and on the north side 2,000 cubits, and the city shall be in the midst. And wow, down to the very cubit. This isn't just general like city planning, you know. This is specific measurements that they're doing, very very specific measurements before they've even stolen the land. And among the cities which ye shall give unto the Levites, there shall be 6 cities for refuge, which ye shall appoint for the manslayer, that he may flee thither, and to whom ye shall add 42 cities. So all the cities which ye shall give to the Levites shall be 48 cities, them shall ye give with their suburbs. And the cities of which ye shall give shall be of the possession of the children of Israel. From them that have many ye shall give many, but from them that have few ye shall give few. Every one shall give of his cities unto the Levites according to his. And it's cut off, and I don't really care. I don't know why this stupid site. I should probably find a new one. Going on. And the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, Speak unto the children of Israel, and say unto them, When ye become over Jordan into the land of Canaan, then ye shall appoint you cities to be cities of refuge for you, that the slayer may flee thither, which killeth any person at unawares. And what a bizarre set of instructions this is. So, I bet Moses was a bit surprised by this. So God's saying, like, all right, Moses, now that we've got these cities all planned out, so first order of business. Moses is like, oh, yeah, sure, let me grab my my pen. So what are we going to cover? You know, governance, elections, you know, common law. Lay it on me. Let's go. Let's do this. Let's plan some cities. Actually, first things first, we are going to need to designate at least 6 cities, and I thought a lot about this number. It's got to be 6. 6 cities where a person can run to if they accidentally kill someone. What? I guess we can do 6 cities. That's weird. Okay, that's sort of out of left field. All right, so anyway, about these cities and what they're going to... No, this is very important. You need to have 6 cities where some... Like, is God planning something that we should be worried about here? Why would he just think of saying that? First thing, first order of business. And he knows his people well. He knows they're going to be getting into some trouble. And they shall be unto you cities for refuge from the avenger, that the manslayer die not until he stand before the congregation in judgment, why not all cities, you know, for that matter? Why six of 48? You know, one eighth. Why not 40? Why not 48, where you can just go to any city? Is there some reason, like, what is the point of that? So people have to, like, memorize which city. Crap, which, I just killed somebody. Oh, can I, which, crap, I memorized these. Which city can I go to? Oh, like, that's has, oh, you went to the wrong city, now we can kill you. What is the point of that? And these cities, and of these cities which ye shall give, six cities shall ye have for refuge. Ye shall give three cities on this side Jordan, and three cities shall ye give in the land of Canaan, which shall be cities of refuge. These six cities shall be a refuge both for the stranger of Israel and for the stranger, for the children of Israel and for the stranger, and for the sojourner among them, that every one that killeth any persons unawares may flee thither. And if he smite him with an instrument of iron, so that he die, he is a murderer, and the murderer shall surely be put to death. And at this moment, every murderer in town was like, okay, where can I get a hold of some copper weapons? Copper, I need copper weapons. All right, how do copper weapons work? Are they hard? Can they kill? They're having conferences. Like, are we killers? Can we do this? Is this manageable? You know, iron is traditionally the most sturdy killing weapon. I like iron. Can we find a way around this? Yeah, I think we can do that. And if he smite him with throwing a stone, wherewith he may die, and he die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. And this gives you an idea of sort of the caliber of society we're dealing with here. That God has to say this. Like, this is anyone who kills someone with a rock by throwing it at him, you know, like, that has to be, I don't think that's really in our legal books, you know, specifically. I know, murder is covered, but I don't think we have separate, like, rock-throwing laws. I think we've sort of outgrown that. But I'm glad millions of people still worship a book written by these cavemen. That's encouraging. Or if he smite him with an hand, weapon of wood, wherewith he may die, and he die, he is a murderer. The murderer shall surely be put to death. The revenger of blood himself shall slay the murderer when he meeteth him, and he shall slay him. But if he thrust him of hatred or hurl at him by laying of weight that he die, or an enmity, smite him with his hand that he die, he that smote him shall surely be put to death, for he is a murderer. The revenge of blood shall slay the murderer when he meeteth him. So pretty much it's saying, if someone kills someone, then whoever's related to that person can kill that person back, which is a great system, fantastic system. As we all know, that is how you want to model, you know, your judicial system. This was the very paramour of Paragon. I think I'm getting something from a play. Paragon of an example of a godly judicial system that we took. Because all the founding fathers, you know, they you hear it all the time on Fox News that they couldn't have done it without, you know, Christianity. They really needed to take this Bible and all the stuff in it and use it to found our nation. That's what they did. No, I don't think they did. Or with any stone wherewith a man may die, seeing him not, and cast it upon him that he die, and was not his enemy, neither sought his harm, then the congregation shall judge between the slayer and the revenger of blood, according to these judgments. And the congregation shall deliver the slayer out of the hand of the revenger of blood, and the congregation shall restore him to the city of refuge, whither he fled, and he shall abide in it unto the death of the high priest, which was anointed with oil. This was a bit of a confusing passage. So the notes were also really not helpful because every single one couldn't, you know, resist the opportunity to point out how this is actually making reference to Jesus. The part at the end about the priest is clearly a reference to Jesus being crucified. I mean, it is clearly, you know, even though it seems like it's quite literally just saying if a person is guilty of manslaughter, He'll have his life spared so long as he remains in a refuge city, and he has to do this until the priest of his old city dies. That even though that's literally what it's saying, somehow it's still a reference to Jesus. Why would this be a reference to Jesus? Also, why would a book, like, God knew this ahead of time? Why would he be so cryptic? You know what would be more impressive is if the book said, until Jesus is crucified for your sins. I know you don't know who that is or what any of that means, but just write it down. Write it down, Moses. Then it would be something, you know. They might not understand at the time, but who cares? They can just, it's just in a book and it'll sit there, and then later we could go, holy crap. Wow, they were onto something. But if the slayer shall at any time come without the border of the city of his refuge, whither he was fled, and the revenger of blood find him without the borders of the city of his refuge, and the revenger of blood kill the slayer, he shall not be guilty of blood, because he should have remained in the city of his refuge until the death of the high priest. But after the death of the high priest, the slayer shall return unto the land of his possession. Yeah. Yeah, clearly a reference to Jesus. Yeah. I guess the lesson here is to make sure to commit manslaughter when the high priest is looking a little iffy, you know, like, I wonder if incidences of manslaughter just started to shoot up once the high priest was, I don't know, getting a little senile, or like he catches a cold and he's 80 and you're like, oh, he's going to go any minute. Okay, I got to, now's my chance. I accidentally killed that guy. I was not his enemy. I did not mean to hurt him. I just, accident. The priest lives for another 40 years. You're like, damn it. I thought I had that all figured out. So these things shall be for a statute of judgment unto you throughout your generations in all your dwellings. Whoso killeth any person, the murderer shall be put to death by the mouth of witnesses. But one witness shall not testify against any person to cause him to die. Yeah, I love this. Witnesses can condemn a man to death, but not one witness. It has to be at least two. Really, God, that's it. So you're saying it's absolutely impossible that two witnesses could be either mistaken or lying? Like, once you get one, maybe, yeah, but two, no. Couldn't be mistaken or lying. No. How about reasonable doubt or a presumption of innocence? Anything? Were these concepts not available to the all-knowing God at the time? You know, he hadn't thought of it yet, so. Moreover, ye shall take no satisfaction for the life of a murderer which is guilty of death, but he shall be surely put to death. And ye shall take no satisfaction for him that is fled to the city of his refuge, that he should come again to dwell in the land until the death of the priest. Here, listen to this note. Let me give you an example of what everybody's saying here. Until the death of the priest, probably intended to typify that no sinner can be delivered from his banishment from God or recover his forfeited inheritance till Jesus Christ, the great high priest, had died for his offenses and risen again in his for his justification. No, sounds to me like he means exactly what he said, the death of the priest. All the language suggests that this happens within their lifetimes and repeatedly, you know, like multiple priests. That's what all the language suggests that. You know what would be a good test for this kind of thing? This kind of, this so-called prophecy that the book is foreseeing. Read it and think, could there have been any possible way that a person reading this at that time would be able to extrapolate all this information about Jesus? Like, would someone back then have, because it doesn't do to just go back, you know, hindsight is 2020. It doesn't do good to just go back and say, like, oh yeah, that's what that meant. No. Would anyone have possibly dreamed all this up about Jesus and dying for their sins and all that prior to it happening? Like when this was first written? No. Of course not. Of course not. So it's not foretelling the future. You're just finding little patterns and things that aren't there. So ye shall not pollute the land wherein ye are, for blood it defileth the land, and the land cannot be cleansed of the blood that is shed therein, but by the blood of him that shed it. Defile not, therefore, the land which ye shall inhabit wherein I dwell, for I, the Lord, dwell among the children of Israel. So that's the end of that chapter. We got one little short one here, just to finish off the book of Numbers. And the chief fathers of the families of the children of Gilead, the son of Machir and the son of Manasseh, of the families of the sons of Joseph, came near and spake before Moses and before the princes of chief, before the princes, the chief fathers of the children of Israel, and said, "The Lord commanded my Lord to give the land for an inheritance by lot to the children of Israel. And my Lord was commanded by the Lord to give the inheritance of Zelophehad, our brother, unto his daughters." Now, if you remember, this was the daughters thing from before where the father died and something about the daughters got the inheritance or something. "And if they married, and if they be married to any of the sons of the other tribes of the children of Israel, then shall their inheritance be taken from the inheritance of our fathers and shall be put to the inheritance of the tribe whereunto they are received." And this is a big problem. "And when the jubile of the children of Israel shall be, then shall their inheritance be put unto the inheritance of the tribe whereunto they are received. So shall their inheritance be taken away from the inheritance of the tribe of our fathers." And Moses commanded the children of Israel according to the word of the Lord, saying, "The tribe of the sons of Joseph hath said well. This is the thing which the Lord doth command concerning the daughters of Zelophehad, saying, Let them marry to whom they think is best, only to the family of the tribe of their father they shall marry." And this is incredible. So the people come to Moses with a problem. They're pretty much like, so you're giving the inheritance of that one guy to his daughters, and we're fine with that. But then what if the daughters marry into another tribe? Then they'll be getting double inheritance. No fair, God. So Moses, he thinks about it and gives this divine bit of wisdom. He says, "Let them marry whoever they want, as long as it's one of their cousins." That's good. Because then, so that'll be in the family, and they won't double their inheritance. I love it. Why does he even bother with the first part? Like, he really says this in the Bible. He says, "I know it was a different time, but how good would you really feel if someone said, all right, you can marry whom you think is best." All right, yeah, wait, let me finish. "Of your cousins." Huh? Of my cousins? Who I think is best of my cousins. That doesn't make sense. I don't want to marry any of my cousins. There's not a best one. There's none. I don't understand why. I love how this wise solution he's come up with. It's great. Love the Bible. Love that Bible. "So shall not the inheritance of the children of Israel remove from tribe to tribe, for every one of the children of Israel shall keep himself to the inheritance of the tribe of his fathers. And every daughter that possesseth an inheritance in any tribe of the children of Israel shall be wife unto one of the family of the tribe of her father, that the children of Israel may enjoy every man the inheritance of his fathers. Neither shall the inheritance remove from one tribe to another tribe, but every one of the tribes of the children of Israel shall keep himself to his own inheritance." You know, that's one idea. Or you could just let anyone marry whoever and figure statistically it'll pretty much balance out. You know, like sometimes you'll lose a little inheritance from people marrying into your family and taking it. And sometimes you'll gain a bit by people marrying out, you know, and figure whatever, it's close enough. That's another way to do it. Is there some reason why the inheritance needs to exactly stay with a family? You know, it seems pretty arbitrary to me. "Even as the Lord commanded Moses, so did the daughters of Zelophehad." So they just did it. They just married their cousins. "For Mala, Tirzah, and Hogla." Well, Hogla could only find a cousin to marry. No one but her cousin would marry her. "And Milcah and Noah, the daughters of Zelophehad, were married unto their father's brother's sons. And they were married into the families of the sons of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, and their inheritance remained in the tribe of the family of their fathers. These are the commandments and the judgments which the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses unto the children of Israel in the plains of Moab by Jordan near Jericho. End of this reading. And that was fun. And we are done with the book of Numbers. And I can't wait to get to Deuteronomy. So as usual, please write an iTunes review. I really would appreciate it. And it's great. And thank you to those who already have. And if you're in for some crude, but really funny, comedy, podcasting, and complaining, check out my other podcast, F This Podcast. But if you just stick with the Bible stuff, that's fine too. And have a great week, and I'll see you guys next week on Thomas and the Bible. Bye.